Brian Hyatt, and this is Rolling Stone Music Now. I'm really happy to be here today with Questlove of The Roots and many, many other projects, who has an excellent book coming out called Creative Quest that could be, in some cases, life-changing, with really concrete strategies to access and maximize your own creativity, as well as astute musical analysis and anecdotes from his own artistic journey. So, what was the initial genesis of this book?
Well, first, I want to thank you for that introduction. Life-changing. This is sound of money that I'm now paying you.
No, we do that off the air. We do that later, yeah.
Okay. Payola still exists. You know, as far as it being a life guide or I'll say that of the four books that I've done, my first one, Mometa, and this current one, Creative Quest, were probably the ones that I was not least excited, but kind of slow to get started.
Uh-huh.
Because, well, I mean, for starters, no one wants to do a memoir, sort of like no one wants to get a life achievement award, because then it's like, okay, guess it's over. So, you know, that sort of thing. And in the case of doing anything that has me in a position where I have to give instructions, like as much as I love spewing my opinion, especially on like social media and, you know, writing these paragraphs and stuff, I personally am very reluctant to take the teacher position. I like to think of myself more like a student.
Yeah. But,
so I guess I was sort of conned into at least giving examples of my own. I can't even say the word success without laughing. So whatever that word, figuring whatever you want to say for success and failures, which I've had a lot of, sort of documenting them. So yeah, I guess it was time to do that. And I didn't realize that there was an audience of people that actually wanted to hear what I had to say about creativity.
And how about the oblique strategies? Have you ever used them? And for people who don't know, this is like a bunch of cards that Brian Eno made.
Yeah.
When you face a creative challenge. I've actually used this myself in my not that creative stories where it's like, try it backwards, that kind of thing.
Well, yeah, I use, always used Post-its.
Yeah.
Around the house. Actually, you know what's weird? Michael Jackson did the same similar thing. And I kind of used to laugh at that because he would, I guess during the making of his Bad album, he would have these 3x5 cards all over his house that said 100 million units, 100 million units, 100 million units. And, you know, I guess you have to sort of psych yourself out in that sort of way. But yeah, in terms of Eno, I've always been a fan of his work. And as far as the what anyone else would see him as obstacles, he sees as a moment to learn from a situation. So I figured that was a good example.
You mentioned Michael Jackson. You had this interesting note that was in the Spike Lee documentary.
Mm-hmm.
MJ will be my new name. This is not you. This is Michael Jackson. Just to be clear, we're not changing your name, MJ. MJ will be my new name. No more Michael Jackson. I want a whole new character, a whole new look. I should be a totally different person. People should never think of me as the kid who sang ABC. I should be a new incredible singer, actor, dancer that will shock the world. I will do no interviews. I will be magic. And you had a mixed reaction to that, but then came around to, it's kind of amazing, I think.
It is. I mean, because at the time that he wrote it, he was 20, which was slightly before, you know, this is during the making of Off the Wall. So it's kind of his do or die moment. You know, I mean, and in hindsight, knowing of him leaving notes to himself to psych himself out. I mean, it's almost like watching, people have those moments. Like if you watch Eminem in the first 10 minutes of 8 Mile, when he's staring in the mirror at himself, he's trying to psych himself up, you know, hype him. Like people do it all the time. They talk to themselves and that sort of thing. But I guess writing it out, maybe your hands manifesting the words sort of creates reaches a deeper surface in your subconscious that, you know, you have to make these things come true. So in the beginning, I thought it was silly, you know, but, you know, I'm an absolute Michael Jackson stan, you know, whatnot. But when I was younger reading that, I was like, you don't have to go that far, dog. Just make good music. But now that I see it, I know people that even go crazier. I don't want to give one artist secret away, but I know a particular artist that they give their own motivational talks in their iPhone.
Uh-huh.
And then they loop it on repeat when they fall asleep in their bedroom.
Whoa.
At a low volume. And
a certain founder of a very popular new religion actually did that, according to biographies of him. So wow, maybe they're going to start a religion too.
We can't name names. Yeah. See, I can't name my name because he'll kill me.
And I don't want to name your name because I'm afraid of this group. So. But you can guess. So we'll just sit here quietly for a minute or two.
Right. So that's not an old idea at all.
No, apparently, I think they're onto something real scary, actually.
I might as well try that. I don't know if I have the patience to sit down and actually craft what I want to hear in my sleep.
I did want to take a step back. Something about reading the book reminded me of a thing that Pauline Kael said about, and I had to look up who she said it about because I couldn't remember who it was. Mm-hmm. She said it about Paul Schrader, actually. She said, "He is smarter than he is talented." Now, I in no way think that about you, but you are very, very smart and very, very talented. And part of what I took away from the book is that those things aid each other, and they may also work against each other. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, okay. I have to say that the one common denominator that we've always gotten as a unit in the Roots is that we overthink things. And really, I kind of have to credit, if people read my first book, Momentum Blues.
And they should.
Yeah. My manager, Richard Nichols, who unfortunately is not with us today.
Yeah.
At the time when I introduced the idea of having someone contradict or sort of have counter notes to whatever my version of whatever the story was, my editors were like, well, no, because no one knows who this guy is. And I don't know. He's a little scary to us and da da da. And I was like, no, you got to understand, like, this is literally like what life is like from 8 a.m. to 11 when I get out of bed, like he and I like texting each other and having these debates and arguments. So I would kind of like to see that manifested. I guess Rich agreed to it knowing that his time on earth was limited because he was dealing with leukemia. And so, but literally from 92 till, you know, till his passing in 2014, that's the point he kept hammering home, that, you know, you have to think in chess moves. And I'll say that, you know, even though Tariq and I had to both drop out of college to pursue this career, Rich kind of became a source of education. I mean, we would just have debates like past like any creative album making, songwriting sessions, whatever. Every day starts with a 4-hour debate on any subject you can think of, be it menstrual entertainment. So I think if anything, Rich just hammering this home, like I don't want people under any impression that, you know, I grew up in this Mensa level household where, you know, it's once you meet Rich, it just wears off on you. And that's where it comes from.
Well, I'll get more specific. And some of this is an issue of intelligence, and some of it is an issue of your nature as a student and a sort of, a follower of tradition. Mm-hmm. But there's an extraordinary part of the book where you talk about Wise Up Goes, the album that the Roots made with Elvis Costello in 2013.
Right.
And Elvis, by the way, told me that there's a whole live album that you guys wanted to put out, which I'd love to hear.
There's so much on the cutting room floor.
Anyway, but you say you're drumming on it, but you're really drumming on it, and it's pronounced Ferroni, right? Steve Ferroni.
That's me as Ferroni.
Yeah. But then you go on to say that you...
Am I me?
Well, both that, but you are so aware of... You can channel so many different drummers. Like, it seems like every drummer who ever lived. Mm-hmm. You have snares that at the Tonight Show, there's a P-Funk one. There's mm-hmm. one named after Gary Katz because he produced or recorded the Steely Dan records. Mm-hmm. There's one from Fish from Fishbone. There's one named after John Bonham. The way that you've cataloged all this stuff in your head, mm-hmm. it does seem like it could be an impediment to creativity.
And that's the thing. Okay, I'm going to tell you something hilarious. So yesterday, on my own podcast, I interviewed Jack White.
Ah, I did his cover story recently, yeah.
Oh, okay. And so we were talking about Meg as a drummer and how his thoughts on her, like, not getting that much respect as a drummer and, you know, all the flack that she went through. And I was telling him, like, I told him the story of the snares, because, like, Get Behind Me, Satan was, like, one of my favorite records when it came out. And so I always loved this idea. Like, Jay Dilla taught me how to slow stuff down, but she taught me how to speed things up. And that's when I never accelerate. It's like, I hate musicians that accelerate. And I know, like, for some songs it's necessary, but it took him a while for him to really register. I was, like, being super sincere, because it's hard to convey to people how you morph. And, you know, as a musician, you morph into them. And I told them, like, I'm more like a student of music as opposed to my own person. Like, I don't know. I know for a fact that I don't have a specific style, but you know it's me when I'm drumming. However, there's a process, there's a mental process I have to go through right before I record. And even if it requires a certain outfit or something, there's a...
Right, that's the other thing that blew my mind, yeah.
I'm trying to remember what album it was. I think... You know, I got it. All right, so... History will eventually show that I've worked with Pharrell a lot, even though there's not evidence of it in the marketplace. I'll just put it this way. For every album that Pharrell has ever released, he's come to me a month before and said, remix my entire album, like, as if I were a member of the Roots. And we do this entire album, like, for all of his records, including the soundtrack to the Space Program. Just came out 2 years ago.
Hidden Figures.
Yeah. Even that. So this is one we were working on in my mind, and there's a song on there that was like, you know, you have to listen to his music and try to figure out, okay, who's he being derivative of? Okay, I get it. And then I got to go in that mode of creating that song. And so next to Bonham, like, Stevie Wonder is my favorite crash cymbal specialist. He has a very distinctive tone in his crash, and... I don't know, to play like Stevie Wonder, I know people are like, are you mocking him or whatever? But no, I get blindfolders, because it's different when you don't know where the drums are and your eyes are closed. There's a more intense level of playing that I get in my dynamics. And even in wardrobe, like, I wore a turtleneck that day because there was a poster that I have of Stevie in the 70s drumming with a brown turtleneck on. So, like, but this is, like, in July, mind you. So it's a weird process. Like, I have to feel like Stevie Wonder, like, and what would he do? So, I mean, but that happens with practically every drummer and every project. So it's weird. Like, I don't have a distinctive style.
But how many even other drummers are aware that Stevie Wonder has a particular crash style as a drummer? You know what I mean? I don't even hear that many other drummers absorbing this level of specificity.
I think you're aware of things. I think for a lot of us that get sucked into music, if you're the youngest of a brood, a bunch of siblings, as I was, you're probably in music early, like, whether you know it or not, usually by the age of 5. Trickle down. Had an older sister. Mom and dad were also record collectors, and, you know, they were in a band and all that. So all these ideas are coming to me. Or usually someone has a cousin or, you know, someone that's hipper that puts them onto something. And it's just Stevie Wonder was, I just happened to be of age at a time where he came into his own, the so-called genius period between Music of My Mind and, you know, I don't, sure. I don't want to end the parenthesis.
But not to belabor, but you actually have a different snare for each album of Stevie's prime period, which is
exactly
truly mind-blowing.
There's three.
But yeah. I want to return very quickly to this idea of Meg White and Jay Dilla, because I really love that, because I know exactly what you're saying. Mm-hmm. Just to unpack it, though, a little bit. I mean, one of the things you learned from Jay Dilla, and it's, again, the irony is really interesting, is you were trying to play in a way that you could be a machine at one point.
Yeah.
Whereas he was making he was doing the opposite. He was making kind of broken mm-hmm. electronic beats, and you had a real epiphany, as we can hear on D'Angelo's work, mm-hmm. of playing the kick out of sync. Just to summarize it, that's the J. Dilla yeah. revolution. Mm-hmm. The Meg revolution, right, is you're saying the opposite. She would play, quote unquote, wrong.
Yeah.
And like the snare maybe would be placed a little too far to the right or whatever.
Like all over Icky Thump and like the last two records between Icky Thump and Get Behind Me, Satan. I mean, really, their whole canon, but yeah. just specifically on those last two records, there's a style of drumming that really can't be duplicated. And even he acknowledged that, because he said that, you know, even if I were to play, I've played these songs with other drummers, and they've either tried to perfect it, or it's a certain nuance that only I can get, because I'm obsessed with meter and timing. Like even in my everyday life, I do. John Mayer also put this on his IG stories. Like, he does it different as a game, but I do the same thing where it's like I'm obsessed with counting. Where uh-huh. like when I leave my door, I try and guess how many paces to the elevator will I land. I for some reason, like when alone or whatever, like I'm just always counting. Even when I leave here, I'm thinking, okay, I'm gonna get to 30 rock in 200 paces. And try to, it's a number obsession and a time obsession thing that I have.
And I think you mentioned in the book that the Bee Gees got the rhythm from jive talking, from like something they heard on the road every day, like a certain bump in the road.
Dude, on the Queens Bridge, there's something similar. When you get on, I guess the 59th Street Bridge or whatever, uh-huh. there's a bunch of textures there's a bunch of steel textures that has a rhythm on there that you can't. Some people get it from that. Some people get it from the dryer of their, you know, washing their clothes. Some people get it from, I can't explain it. Like, rhythm comes from a lot of places that you would least expect it. But yeah, the Bee Gees were driving to a studio and kept hearing a, which in my mind, I was like, well, they had to be doing 70 miles an hour. Like, or at least there was some sort of a texture every. See, only I'm thinking like, okay, was the texture every...
Right, you're doing the math in your head. Like, what speed?
Right.
It's the Bee Gees SATs, yeah. Right, yeah,
yeah, but then yeah. you're like, okay, are they lawful drivers? Are they going under? Like, that's what I'm trying to figure out.
You had a really interesting thing about Jay-Z, and it goes back to this idea you had or have about two types of artists, type A achievers and type B creatives.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting because I think younger people, and also people, I don't know, I think this goes back to an earlier idea of Jay-Z that probably isn't congruent with the way people think of him now, but you thought of him as an achiever.
He was that then.
Right.
He's only letting us see Sean Carter
now. Of course. But now people, it's hard to even explain why you'd think that to, I think, younger people. But it's because you were, you know, you saw him as having a gangster ethos. You saw, you know.
Yeah, like, meaning there was a period, I'd like to say that in 1997, that's sort of the drawing of the gauntlet or whatever you want to say, like the proverbial biting of the apple, where our eyes are open, or whatever imagery you want to use for, like, when did hip hop notice its business potential and stop being just a mindless discovery of art. I feel like 97 was that period. And so much has happened in hip hop during that year. And for me, because of the specific circumstances that occurred, which led to my collaborating with Jay-Z, prime being stuck in New York during 9/11, in which is so weird, we're all in a hotel, and you know, as it's happening, and it's happening in real time in New York, your mentality is either like, oh, this is the apocalypse, this is the end of the world, I gotta get home to safety, you know. And I think I would have thought that had I had a family or a wife and kids. But all the roots are scrambling to get out of the hotel. And I'm like, where are you guys going? They're like, we're going home. Where are you going? And I was like, oh, I'm going to Virgin Megastore to grab Jay-Z's record, because I think I'm about to be stuck in New York with no music. So I ran to Virgin Megastore, paid a cabbie like $100, just wait right here. I'll be back in like 10 minutes. Went to Virgin Megastore and binge shopped like a couple thousand DVDs. It's like, okay, I'm stuck in New York. I might as well entertain myself. And Blueprint was the first and really the only thing I listened to. And maybe it's just I think in that specific moment, like it was the end of the world. This is all I'm listening to on loop for like 13 hours. And I happened to pass word to a mutual friend. I was like, yo, like, I would never say this in public, but yo, I'm really, really feeling this Blueprint record by Jay-Z. Don't tell nobody. And which at the time, I know it's weird now because...
That's what I'm saying. It's hard for people to understand. I totally understand where you're coming from, but yeah.
Hip-hop, yeah. Just between 97 and 2001, hip-hop was in such a sensitive kind of... apartheid, whereas the haves and haves not, like, forget the East Coast and West Coast wars. There was a war within New York between part of it really was hip hop had always been an inclusive thing. Hip hop was like the invention of not being included in everyday society. Like, so all the music genres that got invented in 77. Think of Nile Rodgers not being allowed to go to Studio 54 to see Grace Jones and then making the biggest single in the history of Atlantic Records, La Freak.
Yeah.
Because they couldn't get at. So imagine that for everyone. So thus, you know, the punk movement starting in the East in the East Village, and hip hop started in the Bronx, and then the underground disco music, which morphs into electro and house. And that rejection in 77, that sort of upscale rejection causes all the subcultures to really come to fruition. And if you look through history, any subculture eventually becomes, quote, your parents' music after 20 years, you know, as it should. I mean, so, if not, it would just be go-go. Think of go-go in D.C., which really should have been a thing, but just stayed a subculture. So that's what hip-hop would have been. My point was that, you know, hip-hop was inclusive. So I always gave an example of like Run DMC singing about my Adidas made you think, oh, I too can do that. Right. Go get some shell toes, $60, and I'm just like Run DMC. Whereas Jay-Z's approach was basically like, no, you'll never be me. This is what I have, and you can't be this. You want to be this. And so suddenly hip-hop becomes the very thing that it was once against. So... it was kind of irresistible because the songs were good. His personality and his presentation were flawless that you couldn't even deny it, even though you were theoretically against it. So because there was a civil war going on between the backpack underground versus the mainstream,
right?
For me to admit that publicly could have been... maybe an overthought, a classic Amir overthinking suicide. And even to call him, because he was like, tell him to call me. I want to work with him. It took 2 weeks. And it took a Simpsons joke for the ice to melt. I was like, wait, what do you know about Troy McClure? So after that, I was like, okay, all right, let's work.
I wanted to talk about D'Angelo real quick. Mm-hmm. When I got to interview him for A Black Messiah, and, you know, I think we were supposed to start the interview at 10 p.m. We started at 2 a.m. Yeah. And all that stuff.
What time did you start?
Yeah. It was, and that was the first time. The second time we might have finished at 6 a.m. or something. It was, but I mean, you know, he's...
You and I have the same experience. Yeah.
He's obviously a genius. And, you know, it's, you talk a lot about him with regard to creativity because he is someone who's experienced blocks.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, like, where's he at right now? What do you know about him?
Dare I say, like, still creating some of the most dangerous, mind blowing shit I've ever heard.
He played me a song from the next album, actually, from the next album, and it was very half finished, but it was like a big rock thing. I could barely it also didn't have vocals, so so it was very hard to, like, I didn't know what I was really hearing, but it was very, like, it had a lot of surging. It was very, very different. Very, very cool. I didn't know what to make of it, though.
I don't think block is... I'm sorry, I know your engineer's like, what are you doing? Okay, I don't know if even having block, any sort of creative block, is his thing more than, I guess what I'll dub, I guess a way to paraphrase it is, what's the Fable Guns N' Roses album title? Chinese Democracy.
Yeah.
Yeah. Kind of that syndrome where you don't know where to stop. Mm. We're in that right now. Like, we're at 100 plus songs, and it's like,
for the roots, yeah.
Yeah. Every day it's just like, manager's like, dude, just pick 12. Let's go. Like, summer's here. Pick 12. Let's do it. I feel like he's the same way, which a lot of times, for me, a lot of the artists that are to the left of center have a tendency to overthink things. The voices inside their head kind of puts fear in your voice. I mean, this is the reason why you have to have subliminal sleeping.
Yeah, he needs to make that tape for himself, yeah.
Well, I mean, if you think about it, Michael Jackson, probably the greatest trait of his artistry is he's the only artist on his level that was never afraid to climb the mountain.
Yeah.
Because he's literally the only artist to never make a departure album.
Hmm.
Which, I guess in your... Oh my God. I was about to say, see, in our heads, like I'm a journalist, but I think like a journalist, but in our heads, you know, the departure album, at least from where I was, used to be like, oh man, this is going to be like the artistic experiment. Like, we're going to see them at their best. But later, as I've learned and gotten to know all these characters that are famous for making this stuff, then it hit me like, oh, they're afraid. And this is, you know, sometimes you want to ruin it before you get ruined or that sort of thing.
Oh, wow. That's right.
And then I looked in, and at first I was just looking at kind of my generation, you know, like think of any artist that's ever taken 10 to 20 years to make a follow-up record. But then I just started looking, then I looked at every departure album in history and tried to figure out, okay, let's see their circumstances. And now it's hard for me to see Bitches Brew in the way that we do, or There's a Riot Going On, or Paul's Boutique, or around the World in a Day. He sort of already stated, like, I don't want to make it look like I'm selling out. I mean, it was a sort of an 85 way of thinking, but he already knew that Purple Rain was going to be so mammoth that, you know, I don't want my true fans to think that I'm not an artist and that I'm selling out for the fame. Like, I want to make... So
you got to do your Around the World in a Day. You got to do your Tunnel of Love. You got to do your little retrenchment.
But it's weird. Was Tunnel of Love really the departure record? Like, was Nebraska?
We could get. Well, it's a retrenchment record. I would say that, like a pullback. It's more similar to Around the World in a Day, in the sense that it's like, I did my big thing. I'm gonna pull this thing back a little bit.
You think he was more embarrassed of how Born in the USA sort of got, co-opted and used for the wrong ironic reasons?
That too. This is, I don't want to open this can of worms. We'll talk about it. But yes, yeah. But I was just thinking how those two are similar, and of course they're in the same era. But yeah.
Yeah. So if anything, I think with D'Angelo, you know, he's actively making music. If I can find the time period to come down to the studio, my drums are there, and I will finish work. But as of now, I know that there's 60 songs. I mean, as of a year ago, there were 60. I'm certain now there's at least 100 and blah, 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 blah.
He has that like cave of a studio set up with all his vinyl and stuff.
It's still 1997.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's honestly like he made a little magic place. There's certain magic places I've gotten to get to go to with artists, you know, including Paisley Park. And it's like, but that little, I sometimes almost dream of that little dark space he made for himself, because it really was a little glimpse of a magic thing.
You know what's weird though? Okay, so like 2 weeks ago, James Poison and I started laughing. He's like, yo, man. He's like, have you ever gotten a text from D? I was like, yeah, I text him all the time. And I knew what was coming next. He's like, yo, man, how does he know what emojis are? which is like, that's, he's so stuck in his ways. Like, even when we were making Black Messiah, even though we were in a different studio, it was so weird to see exactly the same elements that made Voodoo in that environment. Like, I was like, yo, the first day I was like, oh, wait, you guys still use the MPC 60? And yo, these box of CDs, what the? And Russ explained to me, like, yeah, just took them out of storage. Like, once the album was done, he preserved everything, put them in storage. And then when it was time to make them, put them back. I'm like, yo, the same candles, the same Nag Champa incense. Like, I remember this, the same holder. Like, I was like, dude, I'm freaked out. Like, this is so 1997. Like, the same CDs and cassettes and his floppy disks. His floppy disk. Like, I made... And to me, it was like, maybe I'm kind of envious of that because as time moves on and technology moves, I sort of move with it and long for, like, damn, I wish I had my Tom from the Things Fall Apart record, which it's somewhere in storage now.
You see, you can reproduce the snare from every Stevie Wonder song, but you didn't bother saving it.
But I can't find myself.
Come on, man. but before we were tragically running out of time.
Sorry.
I
have a tendency to ramble.
Me too. I did want to ask, when Keith Olbermann said that, you know, unfortunate thing about that, the Eminem rap was the first, the freestyle was the first hip hop he'd ever appreciated. You made a 200 song playlist for
him at 5 a.m.
But here's the twist, and this is what I want to ask you about. You didn't actually put any rap songs on it. There's not one. I don't believe there's one actual hip hop song. It was all the kind of everything leading to it. So
right.
I thought that was profound, and I can certainly guess what you were getting at there. But real quick, what was the thinking there?
Well, much to the chagrin of my partners at Pandora, I used another streaming service to make this this list, and my whole goal was to take them to the beginning. And I figured, okay, because of your age, you'll probably, I have to take you back to at least when you were in your 20s, in the early 70s, to bring them to why hip hop is where it is right now. So my plan was, and I will still execute, a thorough list of kind of a timeline of music. So I decided to put in the breakbeats and the soul music that caused Afrika Bambaataa and Kool Herc to spin these records at parties, which will then, you know, my next part would have been sort of a later period of the 70s that leads into early. Like, I literally wanted to take them through the brilliance of why it's such a work of art, which is so hard. I think at the end of the day, it's like there's a write-up I just saw of Donald Glover where they said that, you know, the Atlanta can't receive the amount of accolades that Atlanta should be getting for season two isn't hardly enough. Like, you know, this is MacArthur genius foundation level of writing
for sure,
and that I think it's just often seen that black talent isn't strategic or intellectual. It's just a natural thing.
Right.
And so, you know, rappers rapping, and it's not seen as, that's why when anyone else does, you know, what black people do or seem to do naturally, then it's seen like, oh, it's a work of art. It's amazing. And that, I think it's just the perception of it. So I had to take them to the beginning. And then people discovered my secret Spotify playlist. But
yeah, and I would,
that's all I do. All I do is make playlists.
I would encourage everyone to look that one up. You're listening to Rolling Stone Music Now. I'm Brian Hyatt. We'll have more from my conversation with Questlove when we return. I wanted to ask you, you know, there's this thing, and you mentioned George Clinton, like when I talked to George Clinton recently, you know, he has this thing like, you know, if the new music like annoys you and only the kids like it, then it's probably great, you know, and it's like, and you were taught, I mean, you know, you've embraced modern hip hop and there's obviously so much great stuff.
I got in trouble.
But the stuff you were talking about in the book is like, you know, you mentioned like pretty like mainstream adult hip hop, but what about like this, what about SoundCloud rap? What about, you know, like Lil Xan and stuff? Isn't there, because that's what I was wondering sort of with and Gucci Gang, that's what I'm sort of wondering with the George Clinton theory. Is there ever a point where you're like, man, I'm sorry, this is garbage?
You know? It is literally, okay, I swear to God, not even 3 minutes before I sat in this chair, my friend Kathy, who works at Pitchfork, I told her, I said, look, I need you to help me through this. I gave her my email and I said, give me 20 of your favorite SoundCloud rappers so I can just be aware of it. I'm in a really different place now because as a music lover, I have my specific taste of what my default comfort zone is. But then as a DJ, I'm very much, and I deal with this a lot in the failure portion of, of the book. As a DJ, I think it would at least behoove me to be aware, not in that, like, I'm trying to be down and, you know, you ask your kids, like, oh, so what are you guys listening to? The Tyler, the Creator. Okay, great. That sort of thing. I don't want to be that guy. But it's sort of weird to not get high off your own supply. Like, I'm certain if I would listen to Lil Xan, that album 20 times in a row, I could probably be Stockholm Syndrome into being,
yeah,
like,
I got the same thing. I feel this. If I was going to go interview him, I listened to 20 times, by the 20th time, I might be a fan, you know?
Yeah, and that's scary. Actually, he's weird. I just read his Pitchfork review, and I was like, okay. But I
have to admit, I like a couple of the songs. But anyway, go ahead.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah.
You feel it
in a certain way?
Yeah. I mean, you'll be surprised. Like, well, here's the thing. Just last week, I did something that my boys told me, "Yo, don't do it," because you know what's going to happen. I went on Instagram. Thing was, it's April, and I'm shocked that there's actual complete albums that I like. Like, it's normal. It's just like, oh, I'm feeling this song. I'm feeling this song. I'll take this song. And not listen. But lately, I've been not pressing fast forward or shuffle on my streaming device and actually listening to entire records. And then I was like, can I find 10? And I found 10. And I posted about it, knowing the other 42 million musicians are like, oh, what? I couldn't get no love? Questlove? So, yeah, in Cardi B's record, I was late on Kali Uchi's record, but her album is almost a forefront. But I don't know. I can tell smart music from any genre, and if it's praiseworthy, I'll give it, even though it seems out of character to do it, or I shouldn't be doing it.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
So it's been so great to have Questlove on today. Check out his book, Creative Quest.
Can we close with Lil Xan? No.
Yeah. Now here's 2 hours of Lil Xan here on Volume. Enjoy. And that was my conversation with Questlove, who again has a great new book out called Creative Quest. And despite being a drummer, he actually has more good books than a lot of writers. He also has a book called Mometa Blues that's really good, a memoir, and another one called Something to Food About. And of course, you can see him every night on The Tonight Show with Jimmy Fallon and DJing and playing with the Roots and probably a whole lot of other things as well. So we'll be back next week here on Sirius XM's Volume, Channel 106. And if you can't get enough of us, be sure to follow all the various socials associated with this show, which would be at Sirius XM Volume for our channel here, at Rolling Stone for Rolling Stone, the lovely publication for which I work, and at Hyatt B, which is just me. And in the meantime, we are a podcast. You can download us as a podcast, subscribe to us as a podcast, wherever you get your podcasts, and maybe leave a nice review for us on iTunes. I do read them all and appreciate them, even the crazy mean ones. And we'll see you next week. Thanks for listening.